You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner. 11 lectures, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 8, given in Dornach, on the 13th of August, 1921. Yesterday we looked at how, as human beings, we act within our various aspects or members, physical body, etheric body, astral body, and eye-bearer. We considered what the human soul actually brings about within these members of our being. As you saw, on the one hand, we must place special importance on sensory perception and the way our eye lives within it. And on the other, we saw how memory leads us more into our own inner nature. Here lies something that must be carefully examined. And today I must ask you to follow me into fields of study that may be more difficult to grasp, since only by grasping them is it possible to have serious insight into what is actually connected with our human nature. But let us first recall a few things that were said yesterday. As far as ordinary consciousness is concerned, the eye lives in sense perception, and eye consciousness extends initially only as far as our sense perceptions extend. I am not saying the eye, but eye consciousness. And we relate our thought experiences to what we experience as eye and sense perception. With these thought experiences, we live in our astral body. Let us recapitulate all this once more schematically. In the realm of eye consciousness, we have sense perception. Thus, we have our eye active in this sense perception, and then, in a sense, extend this activity over our astral body, and there experience thoughts. Then we saw that our memories are granted us through the activity of our etheric body. And in the physical body, as I said yesterday, all pictures develop, are formed. Now we have to try to become aware of something that we can become conscious of if we observe our inward selves in a very nuanced way. If you cast your spiritual gaze upon the realm of sense perception and bring thoroughly to mind how eye consciousness unfolds within it, then you will say that we are stimulated from without by these sense perceptions. So if I try to draw a schema of our relationship with our sense perceptions, I have to do this as follows, and there's a diagram. If this is the outer world here, our sense perceptions are stimulated by it. But the eye lives within these sense perceptions that are stimulated in us. This certainly means, therefore, that we ought not to say that our eye, insofar as we become aware of it, lies within us, but rather that we experience it entering us from without. Just as we experience sensory phenomena entering us from without, so we also experience our eye entering us from without. It is, therefore, illusory to say that our eye is within us. If I can put it like this, we breathe the eye in with our sense perceptions, and we can conceive of how we encompass these sense perceptions as a subtler kind of breathing. And therefore, we have to say that this eye actually lives in the outer world and fills us by virtue of our sense perceptions, then continues to fill us when our thoughts attach themselves to these sense perceptions as they penetrate further to the astral body. And so you can see that if you want to rightly picture this relationship of the eye to what we ordinarily speak of as human being, which we conceive of as being confined within our skin, then in fact, and here I will initially draw the eye, E-Y-E, as a representative of sense perceptions, You have to recognize that the I, capital, does not lie within us, but lives here outside us and penetrates into us through the senses. Usually we succumb to the illusion that our I lies within what we call our physical organism. But actually, in relation to this physical organism, the I lives in the outer world, and in a sense extends its feelers or tentacles into our inner world, initially in thought, toward or as far as the astral body. Let us now take a closer look at the world of memories, which are driven upward out of our inward being, as we call it. As this occurs, these memories initially involve an activity within the etheric body, which in turn stimulates thoughts in the astral body. Yet these now arrive in reverse. Ultimately, these originate from the pictures within the physical body. And now, please note that the stimulus underlying memory streams from the physical body to the etheric body. And insofar as the I is within this stream, so it also lives here. So to draw this schematically, I have to conceive of the I as not only being here outside us, but also within the physical body, from where it stimulates memories, which then become thoughts. You can see, therefore, that the schema I have drawn isn't at all sufficient. I would have to draw it differently. Not only I, astral body, etheric body, physical body, but if I am considering memory, then what is at the top as I must also find its place in the physical body too, and there's another diagram. It is at one and the same time both distinct in itself and yet also fills the physical body. You see, by careful perception of what occurs within us, it is possible to develop a picture of the incorporation of this I, how it lives in the outer world on the one hand, but on the other hand also within us. And consider the following occurrence. Let's imagine that you meet someone on the street, so you have a sense perception of them. Your I is within this perception, but at the same time, the memory rises within you, and you recognize the person. The memory comes from within, and from without come the sense perceptions. There is an interplay between them. This phenomenon of interplay is something that instinctively endowed spiritual investigators of ancient times knew about. We are drawing this forth again from the sum of facts we have considered. What I have now once more drawn from the whole context of these realities was known to ancient spiritual seers, and they were accustomed to recording such things in images. What I have just described to you, this presence of the I and its encounter with what comes from without, they drew as the serpent that bites its own tail. In other words, our human relationship to the outer world was depicted as the serpent that bites its own tail. Often, when one looks at ancient depictions that arose from instinctive seership, one can discern deep insights hidden within them. People with a penchant for abstraction then come along and read all sorts of things into these images. They arrive at terribly ingenious interpretations, which are worthless, in fact. For you can interpret and symbolize until the cows come home, but such rational interpretation cannot encompass what is actually contained in such images, which can only be discovered by returning to their originating sources. But now, let us take another picture to call to mind what is actually happening here. Let us consider this human eye as it exists in sense perception and in the thought that connects with it. The truth is, we are living in an illusion that has come about in the following way. Imagine that you have a mirror and you see yourself in it. And now let us assume, hypothetically, that you had never had the opportunity previously to know yourself except as a mirror image. And this had led you, try to imagine what this would be like, to confuse yourself with the picture in the mirror. The image in the mirror moves hither and thither. So now let us say that you do not feel yourself within your skin, but you see the mirror image moving around and you think that this is you. You keep telling yourself, "This is me." You look at your reflection and mistake it for yourself. Actually, that is just what we do. The eye is like a stream that bears sensory stimulus to the body. The body reflects it back. Firstly, the element within which the actual eye itself exists. The eye is here, but it is also in the outer world. And it is even in the physical body, but it is reflected back to you. We do not perceive our true eye, but its reflection. We perceive this reflection by virtue of our sense impressions, which are mirror images. I describe this in more detail in my book titled Riddles of the Soul. Thoughts, too, are reflected images, are reflections of experiences in the outer world. The eye really lives in the outer world and experiences itself in the human mind when what it stimulates in the body as unconscious eye is reflected back to it. So that is what we find when we consider sense perceptions and thought. But things are different when memory arises. There we really are with our eye inside the pictures that have come about, though now this process is to a very great extent unconscious. Just think how difficult it is to access memories, how little you can bring this about by means of your fully rational mind. Here, something unconscious is at work. Actually, and you can feel this, a reality is at work. This is different. You now no longer confuse what you see with your eye, for you feel yourself living within this activity. Yet it remains very obscure. This eye, as I have often mentioned, remains in an inner activity that resembles a dream, or even something asleep, for the will is at work there. Basically, the will works within memory. A will that is remarkably fluctuating and changeable is at work within it. And if we seek a metaphor for this, we can say, let us imagine that we gaze like this spiritually with our eye. Whenever we have sense perception and thought, we are gazing out like this. Whenever we form memories and everything that belongs to them, in a sense, we turn the soul around. Actually, this concept of inner reversal, when we pass from sense perception to memory, is important. We turn around inwardly. If you picture this inward reversal to yourself, you gain an inner idea of mobility. You cannot simply place these categories side by side, eye, astral body, etheric body, and physical body. This may be convenient when lecturing on anthroposophy to groups of anthroposophists who want some nice, untroublesome ideas which they can enjoy at their ease. But this is not in accord with reality. In reality, if we study the human being, the life of the human soul, we must pay heed to a continual inversion and change around of our whole inner nature, thus of our real nature. The eye in this mode shines into us through our sense perceptions. But in this mode reversed, it shines upward from the physical body. So our concepts, too, have to become mobile. And this, in turn, shows us how we must develop mobility, inwardly living concepts, if we wish to comprehend the human being. Just consider the nature of our ordinary, everyday soul life. You see one thing, someone else sees something else in the outer world. It is all sense world, which penetrates our world of thoughts. And all kinds of memories surface as this happens. You have to picture it like this. In the realm of sense perceptions, your soul is looking one way, while it looks the other way whenever memories arise. But these two realms continually interpenetrate, and so you must think of the soul as being in a constant flux and vortex of motion. And this is actually the picture we must hold in our minds, the soul in inward, spiraling motion. This is what happens to inner vision. And this is why in my books I have suggested and repeatedly emphasized that in trying to make drawings that correspond to the reality of the higher members of human nature, one is in the same predicament as an artist who tries to paint lightning. Just as little as you can actually paint lightning, so likewise the system of our higher members cannot be painted either. Even the etheric body cannot actually be painted. You can do it schematically, but you cannot capture its reality like this, since in fact it never stays still for a moment. As I was saying, memory and impressions of the outer world encounter and come up against one another. And here we meet something that needs to be understood very precisely. Looking at the human physical body as such, as far as memory is concerned, the I dwells within it. But the I is also in the surrounding world. Thus, the I is actually in everything that underlies sense perceptions. Yet it is also in our physical body. If you study all kinds of modern philosophy, and this modern era has already been going on a long time, you will read a great deal about subjective and objective. That is fine as long as you stay in the realm of thought, for then you can perfectly well distinguish between what lives inside you and what lives outside you. But if you delve deeper into these matters, such concepts lose their meaning. For in what way is what lives behind our sense perceptions, out of which the eye brings perceptions into us, objective? It is objective in the very same way as this physical body is objective. There is no difference here between subjective and objective. The eye lives in the outer world in the same way as it lives within our own physical body, and so the distinction between subjective and objective ceases here. This opposition between subjective and objective only arises when we are up here, in thoughts. And why does it arise? It is not actually for the reasons one usually supposes, but it appears here because we are concerned in this realm only with pictures. Up here we only experience pictures, which are in themselves nothing real. And we feel this when we experience pictures, and so we speak of them as subjective. Whereas, we call the processes underlying the pictures objective. But we cannot say the same of our impressions of the surrounding world, since the processes in which the eye lives are naturally objective here. And likewise, the processes through which the eye acts when it releases memory pictures in the physical body. That is all objective, as well as, if you like, subjective. Here, subjective and objective entirely collapse into each other, and can no longer be separately distinguished. And this is the important thing. For this concept of subjective and objective is something with which people are endlessly preoccupied, which much philosophy juggles with. But now, however, there is still something deeper underlying this. We live initially in our daily experiences, in which we develop the kind of mundane inner life that is universally familiar. But behind all this, of course, lives a completely different world. In Title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, and in Title Occult Science, I described how one can access this world. But what spiritual investigation accesses in this way is, of course, also a reality for each and every human being. This realm is always there, whether one knows it or not. So if we are speaking of reality, we have to take account of it. And if we now develop those modes of cognition that arise in imagination, inspiration, and intuition, we arrive at what is present in every human being, what every single person continually bears within them. If, as I have described, we ascend to imagination, we first meet there a soul world that is different from the one available in everyday life. Through imagination, we receive not the ordinary abstract thoughts, but pictures, which is why the expression imagination or imaginative thinking is used, that we become clearly conscious of as pictures. In respect of imaginations, we have the very clear awareness that we are concerned with pictures. This is the difference between what the spiritual investigator beholds and what appears in dreams or hallucinations. If you live in dreams or hallucinations, you regard your pictures as reality. The spiritual investigator will never do this. Only those who try to refute what the spiritual investigator beholds as hallucinations or dreams suggest this, but it is fatuous to do so. A spiritual investigator will never confuse what they behold in pictures with reality. Yet, on the other hand, they will also be aware that by their very nature these pictures are not invented, are not the products of fantasy, but are pictures that point or refer to a spiritual reality. So firstly, they never confuse their pictures with realities, but are clear that these pictures point to spiritual realities. There are various things that can lead us to be fully aware, both of this pictorial nature on the one hand, and on the other, of the fact that such pictures point to a world of spirit. As a properly judicious person, we have a clear consciousness of the fact that we ourselves link one thought with another, or make distinctions. We need only be clear in our judgment to recognize this. Just consider what your inner life would be like if you could not voluntarily connect the thoughts you have with each other, but if instead these thoughts linked with each other compulsively or involuntarily. You would be like a robot. This inner ability to connect thoughts and to distinguish between them does not actually cease, in a sense, when you enter the imaginative world. And you have to know that this happens, since then you can be clearly aware that the freedom we so highly esteem can only be experienced and acquired in this physical world, between birth and death. Then we also gain a clear sense that our descent from worlds of spirit into this physical world is not an unnecessary one. If we lived only in worlds of spirit, as we do between death and a new birth, we would never be able to acquire freedom there. It is something we can only achieve by our efforts within the physical world. Only those who care nothing for freedom hate or hold in low regard this world we live in between birth and death. We can especially value this freedom if we develop it as power. Let us say, like a memory, after death. Only by feeling our way back into earthly life can we partake of freedom between death and a new birth. In order to partake of freedom, also between death and a new birth, we have to remain connected with earth life. Spiritual investigators gain a real sense of this by living their way into the imaginative world. If, before they work their way into the world of spirit, they did not stand firmly on the ground of physical reality, they would not enter the world of spirit in a sound and healthy way. And so we have to keep reiterating that we must have prepared ourselves well in the physical world before we work our way into the world of spirit. We must really have gained by our efforts everything that we can in principle gain in the physical world. That is, an ability not to surrender to instincts, which signifies unfreedom, not surrendering to any unthinking habitual rules of conduct, which people so like to abide by. We must really have come to an awareness of our freedom before we can gain entry to the world of spirit. Thoughts such as those I elaborated in title The Philosophy of Freedom are ones that people should bring to life within them if they really wish to achieve their ascent into the spiritual world. This is something I also emphasized in title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. In talking of the pictures of imagination, we must see this as being something certainly subjective. In fact, you can say that the degree of subjectivity of our experience is still greater in imaginative life than in ordinary daily life. So life becomes richer in imaginations, but it is a pictorial experience. We know that true reality lies behind this picturing experience, but what we first behold and experience are the pictures. But now there is something living in such pictures, which makes them seem less free in relation to ourselves. We cannot connect, distinguish, and separate them. And if we did connect and distinguish these pictures of imaginative cognition in the way we do with our ordinary thoughts, then we would not reach reality by this means. Our experience of ordinary thoughts is like this. Here is one thought, here the next, and here is the third. We experience each and form connections between them. We have the thought rose, then the thought beautiful, then the thought that I like it. The inner connections I create between the thoughts involves an inner activity on my part. This depends on me, and I am free within it. We are not free in the same way in the imaginative world. When you have the pictures of the imaginative world, it is not the case that you then feel an inner activity by means of which you connect or separate these pictures. That cannot be so. For while you feel yourself free in the physical world and can there connect and make distinctions, you do so as the outer physical sensory world requires. Thus you have a principle which regulates your making of connections and distinctions. In the imaginative world, you have to have a regulating principle too, but what you must not do is to take into this imaginative world the dictates of the physical world. That is what nebulous fantasists do, or more positively, also perhaps what people with strong imaginations do. They take things from the physical sense world and make connections and distinctions between them in an arbitrary way, however they like. This can produce very beautiful results, but must not happen in the case of imaginative cognition. Here something must be at work that gives true cause to connect one part with another, to create connections. If you follow this further, you will see that we arrive at something living in the imaginative world, working within it as otherwise our rational mind works here in the ordinary physical world when it makes connections and distinctions. We arrive in an objective realm. We come to a realm underlying the world given as sensory impressions. Nevertheless, we do come to a principle that makes connections and distinctions. What is this? I'll put it like this. You experience how the imaginations begin to unfold their own inherent life. A metaphor for this might be a human embryo at a very early stage in its development. The head has already developed to a large extent, while the other organs attach to it in as yet only rudimentary form, but they are slowly acquiring their form. In the same way, what lives in the imaginative world grows inwardly. You cannot attach thoughts to each other here in an arbitrary way, but the connections arise by themselves. In other words, something arises in this process that has its own life and ordering principle, and we gradually discern this to be the world we call that of the third hierarchy, the world of Angeloi, Arch-Angeloi, and Archai. Here we work our way into a very real, living process of human experience. I have described it to you here as a process of cognition, of knowledge, but it is not merely that. For what is at work here is what lives within the I, capital, and the astral body. Now consider this. In childhood, we slowly grow and develop. Firstly, up to the age of 6 or 7, we internalize in us all that we imitate. Then, up to the age of 13 or 14, we internalize the world we accept on authority, and so on. If we are able to observe life, we will find how much, though of course not everything, of what we absorb by virtue of the sense impressions we receive and the thoughts we elaborate from them enters us in such a way that it can later be discerned, read, in a person's face. Compare the dull face of someone who was unable to receive anything, who was unable to assimilate sense impressions and elaborate them into thoughts, with the eloquent face, the eloquent physiognomy of someone who, as a child, learned to receive and assimilate the sense world and elaborate it in thoughts. Something of the soul spiritual realm indeed lives in us here and shapes us. I would say that it is the subtlest element at work in us, which also in the subtlest way extends its powers into the whole physical life of a human being. If we can observe others, we can discern from their gait in later life whether or not they had a happy childhood, or one that sometimes comes about in modern schools. What works here from the eye and astral body into the whole human being is not an unreality. The spiritual investigator is only observing what actually lives in the eye and astral body, discerning and discovering it through his imaginative world. He discovers here the world of angeloi, archangeloi, and archai, which in turn informs what develops in a human being through the principle of spirit-soul shaping them as they grow, shaping them in a way that is initially individual. We can observe this in the way I have just described. But this process of development and shaping also pertains to a whole group of people, a nation. Here we distinguish what develops in a person insofar as they belong to a group, a nation, and also we distinguish between a modern human being and an ancient Greek. In brief, we discern a human being's individual development, which depends upon the hierarchy of the angeloi. Then, the whole cultural development pertaining to diverse peoples and nations, brought about by the hierarchy of the archangeloi. And then, we distinguish the differing nature of human beings in different eras and epochs, brought about by the hierarchy of the archai. What spiritual science discovers are the realities at work in the time spirits, the nation spirits, in the spirits who bear the life of each individual out of consciousness into constitutional organic life. We do not ourselves make our own physiognomies as a clockmaker makes a clock, simply by having been educated in youth to be cheerful in outlook and therefore acquiring a friendly countenance. No, something more has to help. A being from the hierarchy of the angeloi helps too. And quite definitely, we do not ourselves place ourselves amidst a people, a nation, and create the diverse national physiognomies as a clockmaker makes a clock. So as you see, we come here to realities which knowledge, cognition, only records, but which are actively at work within us. Here we have the human being from one perspective, as ancient seers would put it, from the perspective of the head of the snake. Now, let us tackle the matter from the other perspective, the tail of the snake. We do so when we turn to the world of memories that rise up from below, rising from where we also discern the world in which, in quotes, subjective and, in quotes, objective, lose their meaning. Yes, the power of memory that rises here is certainly encompassed by the I, capital, but it rises from very subterranean depths of human nature. We know, or at least we can know, how intimately we are bound up with this human nature when we unfold the power of memory. It points us far deeper into our being than we can reach with soul experience in ordinary life. It points us into the depths of something that we are, certainly, but are in the same way as the world of outer nature. There is something within us which is exactly the same as the natural world outside us. and we are not connected with it in the same intimate way as we are with the world we understand in terms of the hierarchy of angels, archangels, and archai. Here something holds sway that is not nearly so close to our contemporary mind. I would put it like this. There is only a thin veil between our modern mind and the angels, archangels, and archai. But when we descend into our inward human condition, from which the power of memory shines upward, and of which you can say we can still just about catch a glimmer, we descend into a world deeply concealed from our modern consciousness. And this glimmer we can catch is connected with contents that lie beyond the scope of the ordinary mind. But in the same way that we can reach the world I characterized before, from which, in our thoughts, we are separated as if by a thin skin, so now, advancing in our spiritual scientific investigations, we can also discern this other realm, the side we come to when we turn ourselves around, or, you can say, turn toward the other end of the snake. We can reach this world if we raise ourselves to the third level of spirit perception, to intuition. And then we reach the beings named in my books as seraphim, cherubim, and thrones. This is the world of cherubim, seraphim, and thrones, who stand behind what actively shines up into our soul life as memory, in the same way that the world of the angeloi, archangeloi, and archai lives behind our sense perceptions and thoughts. Tomorrow, we will go on to speak of the connections between the human world, living with its memories, and these hierarchies, and then also what stands midway between them, Kyriotetes, Dunamis, and Exousiae. The end of Lecture 8.